And we are back. Thank you for joining us for my favorite part of the show. It's the interview segment. And I am joined today by my Daily Dots companion, Mr. Chase Taylor, Brain Trust. And we're going to get back to our normal interview. Explain this on the show. So if bear with me for a second. Because maybe you didn't listen to the show. But we talked about this. We're going to return to our normal interview schedules next week. Got some great ones lined up. But we've been watching this market and the levels that it's been trading at for quite a while. We've been telling you guys how important we thought some of these levels were. And we were having a discussion earlier today, like we do, probably at least once a week, just about, you know, how we're positioned, how we're putting things on, how we're going to manage things going forward. And I kind of stopped halfway through and I was like, you know what, man, honestly, I think it'd be best if we just put this on the program. And I kind of explained on the show, I sometimes think it's helpful not to hear what we have to say, but rather just kind of hear how we process things or we think about things. And, you know, even if you're a home gamer doing it on your own, I would think, I mean, it always helped me to hear people that were, you know, managing bigger amounts of money or, you know, listening to the way that they did. Anyway, so we just thought it'd be a good opportunity for you guys to, you know, if you're potential clients listening to the way that we think, if you manage your own money, maybe getting some ideas. But we've always gotten positive feedback in the past when we do these segments, so we thought we'd do it again. So anyway, flip it over to you, Chase. Interesting week.
This is the longest week of my life.
Yeah. There's so I don't even know where to start, man. Other than the fact that this just seems to get, I try to think of the right word. Maybe you can help me fill it in, but it just seems to get wilder and wilder every week. I see less and less. It seems like it's becoming like a more and more imaginative market, like meaning more fanciful in some ways. Like, you know, we've seen a lot of crazy stuff, but it is pretty interesting to watch, you know, high, like non-economically priced technology companies ripping alongside rates.
You know, that was pretty intense today.
That was wild.
Which, as we always say, you can get anything in one day, but to see the jobs report essentially take a cut away and add, you know, close to 20 basis points to the entire curve in one day, and obviously, you know, like Meta and Amazon made sense because their quarter told you like they deserved it. But then to see, you know, some of the other names that maybe don't fit that profile, just go ahead and latch on to. And not only that, but to have the rampage that you're seeing in tech and just the entire market. And then to go look at small caps or equal weight, or just to look at all 500 stocks, see how many are up or down on the year, and to realize like you just have a couple winners and a bunch of losers, and it's just crazy to kind of watch in real time.
Yeah, the stock market is 7 stocks if you want to make money.
And as of this past week, 5. So
yeah, 5.
Well, 4 really.
5. And it's really incredible to watch, and I think that you're setting up you said something earlier today and I really agree with it, and I really don't think it's too far from here. Which is, you know, if you're going to break out with this kind of veracity, with this kind of backdrop, with the threat of inflation reigniting and rates going higher and the rest of the stuff around the world, I think that you gotta, nobody including you or me knows exactly how it's going to play out or what it's going to look like, but I think that you need to get imaginative right now. And I feel like there's a need to widen your scope of imagination. And here's what I'm saying. If you have two companies right now that people are aggressively purchasing, like a Netflix and a Tesla, at their valuations, at the financial performance both of them put out in this environment, I think you can make an easy case for the FANG names and the Mag 7 trading at an average of 60 to 70 times earnings, right? And if they're trading at levels like that, you and I both know that what NASDAQ and S&P are probably 50 to 70% higher in that event.
Oh, yeah.
Right? What I'm saying is, I'm not saying this is my call. What I'm saying is, I think you can see it from here. I think if you told me right now that the NASDAQ was going to double over the next 14 to 16 months, I'm not betting my house you're wrong.
No, not at all.
And here's the narrative. Well, yeah, but they're trading at 50, 60 times earnings. That's insane. Yeah, but they're the only companies in the world that continue to grow earnings during a recession. That ain't, and you've already got them. You and I both know. Look,
they have all the tailwinds.
If you had Netflix and Tesla trading at the same valuations right now as those companies, I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole, right? But the market, you see several of these examples. You know, like this is a market right now that's paying double the multiple for Netflix than does Google. That's a market where Google, those big tech names, could easily double from here.
Right. You could have a just a rotation from, you know, from three of the Mag 7s to another three of the Mag 7s, but still have it be enough to drag the entire index higher.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, if I had the option to buy Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and Meta, right, at these valuations right now, you know, I'm trying to think, you know, or so many of these other companies, but I mean, you know, if you had put a gun in my head right now and said I had to buy those companies or, you know, I don't know, even some lower multiple names and I had to hold them for the next 5 years and not touch them. I mean, I'd be, yeah, on the valuation side. You know, the other side of it too, is you can look at on a price to earnings ratio. Now, Microsoft is nosebleed expensive, but on a price to earnings ratio, as far as the rest of them go, in a marketplace like this, not only do I say I think you can see the justification for it, but in a marketplace like this, if you're going to continue to pay up 50 and 60 times earnings for companies that aren't growing, I think it's a pretty – I don't think it's a stretch to say that those companies are too cheap. They're recession-proof, man.
That I'm not maybe quite as convinced of, but
I'm not saying that that's what I think's happening. I'm saying that is the next line of logic to justify the next leg up on those things, and you can see it right now.
So what I'll say it justifies the next leg is here's the way I look at it. You have three just massive forces that could create a blow off top. Number one, productivity being more or less all of a sudden at kind of essentially a generational high. You're at the top end of the range of the last two decades, and you've spent some time above that range. So you have we'll call it above trend productivity that could turn into a productivity boom. Then on top of that, you have the Fed that very well may be about to cut, despite the fact that the economy is incredibly strong. Just those two. If I was just to tell you, look, you're gonna have very strong productivity, and the Fed's gonna cut into it. You got 4% growth. You're gonna have jobs booming. You're gonna have real incomes rising pretty substantially, and we're just gonna cut interest rates in that environment. And oh, by the way, we're going to run a really, really big deficit, and Congress is talking about cutting taxes right now. Like, hey, here's a giant deficit, a productivity boom, and we're going to cut rates despite the fact that growth is reaccelerating. Like, I could not even imagine a better environment to have a blow off top in equities than that. And that,
well,
we're staring down the barrel of all three of those things.
You still think there's a productivity boom? I don't. I know. I know the productivity numbers are saying it. I just think they're nonsense.
Well, here's what I would say. You're viewing a lot of things through the prism of this doesn't make sense. This data doesn't make sense unless. And you're going with undercounting inflation, overcounting growth. It does make sense if you're having that much productivity.
You're not.
You don't know that. You can't say you're not.
You're having it at maybe five or seven companies.
I don't think that's true.
Then why are all the other – if that is the case, why is almost every other sector out there by and large suffering? And not suffering, that's too strong a word, but pinched. Okay, you'd see it in other places.
Not necessarily. Like I think you can just use the basic passive flow narrative thesis to explain why only the top does well.
I think the majority of it's the work from home effect. I think that's making productivity numbers look way bigger than they are. I think that has way more to do with it than anything like AI or anything emerging big boom. I just think companies are dropping headcounts because they can. I think companies are...
But companies aren't dropping headcounts. The labor data is incredibly strong. They're dropping hours.
Okay, whatever. Call it what you want. But the labor data is strong. But every single time I look, the data for me is really hard to interpret because all I'm seeing are companies that are supposed to be part of the big growth curve and part of the productivity boom. All I keep seeing is news about how they're cutting staff.
Oh, yeah, but
you hear big swaths of hiring and stuff like that.
But remember,
you have to look at what's going on economy-wide.
The churn for labor is like millions and millions of jobs, every quarter. So to see so-and-so is letting 15,000 people go, that's a drop in the ocean.
No, I understand that. Yeah, I'm not economically illiterate. I get that.
well, then you can't, to me, cite headlines so-and-so's letting some people go. That's always going to be the case. And we have the job cut data from Challenger Gray. They actually track the job cuts, and it's down 20% year over year. So we know compared to last year, we're letting less people go. Tech let a lot of people go in 2022 and even parts of 2023.
I think this is a perfect environment to say strong convictions loosely held. I have no idea what's going on. I have no problem saying that. I think anybody that says they do is full of it. I think there's so much conflicting data. I think that we are going to find out that, and I can see it going in 18 different directions, not all, one way. I just think we're going to find out. I just think a lot of dust has to settle to make things look clear. The problem I have with any of these theses to me is it doesn't line up with reality on the ground to go back to what you were saying earlier, meaning none of the, not like, so we can cite two or three factors and go, well, yeah, this looks like productivity is really blown off. Look at the numbers. Then you can look at something over here that is completely conflicting that. And I just feel like that's what you've got. You've got these trade-offs all the time, right? Like the strong jobs report and yet dropping hours at the same time. We know that there are things going on in these data collections or these data numbers that are abnormal, that are noise. What it means at this point, I don't know. Right? I think
it means productivity is pretty high and that to be super clear here though, productivity is not a thing you can just put your finger on and go, here it is. It's so difficult to measure.
I understand that, but think about the work from home thing. Okay, so when we're ready to chalk up productivity to some technological advance that's going to be making everything better into the future, do you know how much money and time it's think of the square footage that Amazon has dropped from their list of expenditures over the last year and a half, just with the Seattle office space they've given up, right? Think about all the people working from home. Think of the overhead costs, all that kind of stuff that come out of it. I am tempted when I look at everything right now, I'm kind of just sitting there going, look, again, I could be wrong, but I think the vast majority of these productivity numbers are just from people working at home. I mean, that it makes the most sense to me. I don't really see where...
At the same time, a lot of people really slack off at home, I feel like. So,
well, yeah, but
we also heard stories, a lot of them actually, of people that are taking two full-time remote jobs, never not telling either employee that they're doing it,
right,
and just getting full-blown two giant paychecks because they can pull it off.
Well, yeah, but how many? Okay, but let's stop.
That would to me, that would suggest a pretty big tailwind for productivity when one person's doing two real jobs.
Okay, so in my opinion, let's get back to reality here. Let's talk any Fortune 500 company, in the country that you want to look at. How many employees, as a percentage, do you think are actually producing work in those companies that equals an output? Or equals what their compensation is over the course of the year. I would bet you the percentage is less than 25%.
Yeah, I've always viewed stuff like that as basically 80-20.
Yeah, I mean, it usually always comes out to 80-20, right? Okay, well, if you get a big chunk of those people working from home, I'm not saying all of a sudden they're going to become dynamos and like crushing corporate America. But guess what? You're not doing. You're not paying nearly as much for their for their mediocre performance, right? You're just I don't think you can look at AI in any other way to say that AI is going to be a productivity booster. And I'm sure at the margins, like I know some people that have already used ChatGPT to help out productivity. Like,
yeah, you see people like build a presentation on it, things like that, that saves you an hour.
Yeah.
Like, is that's it, not nothing. I mean,
no. But is it big enough to show up in economic data at this point? If it is, it's very much at the margin.
I agree.
Right. So then where's,
or I should say, I assume.
So where's the productivity shift coming from? I don't really see any other thing that you could chalk it up to other than, but I also don't think that's insignificant. Like when you think about, for instance, in Bellevue alone right now, I believe Bellevue is a suburb of Seattle, but in Bellevue alone, I want to say you've got 1.5 million square feet of office space that's empty. It sucks for the bank that owns the paper, but think about the rent payments and the lease payments that the people that were occupying that aren't paying anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that's where the productivity is at. But this clearly, I will say this. This, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I got to eat some Corral on this one, but really hard to see a recession coming out of these numbers at any time in the next 4 quarters, unless something really drastic were to happen in a very short period of time. Do you think that's too Pollyannish of a view?
I'm not willing to go 4 quarters, I think it depends on – it hinges on two things. Construction employment, number one, which was positive again today. And number two, asset prices. Like, but as long as asset prices are going up and construction employment is not in a drawdown of over 5%, it's basically impossible to have a recession. Obviously, if other employment breaks and construction doesn't, like,
to go along with that, had an interesting conversation with a real estate agent today. Real estate agent was telling me the subject of rates came up. Real estate agent said that she's seeing increasing numbers of people doing asset backed loans to buy houses on their securities portfolios as opposed to traditional mortgages. And they're getting a cheaper rate, like 100 to 120 basis points cheaper than traditional mortgages. So to go to your point, as that account goes higher and higher, right? There you go.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
I think it's going to be really funny when the Fed finally realizes that.
Every time you see one of these hot data prints, you're just like, yeah, that's what happens when you make everyone way richer.
It's going to be fascinating to me because I believe at some point the Fed will have to acknowledge it and start, but when the Fed realizes that asset prices actually feed into inflation, which I think is hilarious that they don't think that there's a knock. They don't think that those are related, but
they cared about it a year ago.
That's the other thing.
But now that inflation's gone, they don't care about any of the transmission, mechanisms, because who cares? We won. Like we got it. So,
they don't even make sense to each other. Like like you said, I thought you put it perfectly. What were we talking about with, they were like, yeah, we can't do this until inflation comes down. And then they flip around right around so when inflation's going up, they've got one set of rules, but the inverse of that set of rules does not apply when inflation comes back down.
Yeah. If you follow them closely, you, the longer you do, the more you realize they're kind of making it up as they go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the perfect way to look at them, and I don't want to take credit for this because I don't remember off the top of my head who said it first, but I think the way to look at them is to think about like the spiritual shaman that led cultures like 1,000 years ago, that are playing with chicken bones and stuff like that, they won't go to war unless they talk to them, they got to get the blessing from them. And of course those guys didn't know what the heck they were doing, but everybody believed they did.
Yeah.
And again, it's not me knocking on them. Just look at if you want to know what we're talking about, pay attention to the Fed and watch how fast they go back against what they were just saying 12 months ago was gospel.
Or pointing to things that they didn't care about and vice versa.
Yeah.
By the way, this episode should be named Jay Powell's Chicken Bones.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. The Shaman Powell. Shaman Powell's Chicken Bones.
Who is going to be on 60 Minutes on Sunday night. So that the little birdie that dropped that nugget was correct.
Hey, well, yeah, but the birdie that I'm interested in is the birdie that heard our debate about that, because my point was the only reason I think he'd go on 60 minutes is if he wasn't going to raise or if he wasn't going to cut.
Well, it's pretty obvious now, like they're not cutting in March, but
just say it then. Just say the two words. Just,
oh, he's not. Well,
No. Those aren't the words I'm talking about.
No.
You're right. You were right. Give me the three words.
There was no explicit March discussion there. It was whether or not he would be more or less hawkish or dovish. And I think he's got other people on his committee that he has to convince to go along with him because he wants to cut. So my assumption is he's going to talk directly to the American people, let them know they're above the politics stuff, but then is going to basically indirectly talk to the people on the committee to be like, hey, it's time to cut. Granted, that's a little more awkward after the jobs print, and we are assured by a couple folks that he did not have the numbers when he did the interview yesterday.
Okay, so let's make a gentleman's bet.
Okay.
Okay, $100. $100 to a charity. No. Let's flip this around. I want to make this more self-serving than that. $100 lunch for the office.
More self-serving than charity.
Well, yeah, because I want a good lunch out of this. And I shouldn't even say, you guys will think I'm a bad human being. We give a lot to charity, a lot more than $100. Lunch for the office. Okay, if he comes out hawkish, I'm buying.
The problem is the subjectivity.
No, if he's hawkish, you're buying. If he's dovish, I'm buying.
If we can agree.
Oh, come on.
On whether he was hawkish or dovish, sure.
We're going to agree on that.
I don't know. He might hit it right down the fairway on this.
Then why would he go on 60 minutes? If he was trying to hit it right down the
And word on the street is he literally asked to go on. It wasn't like they were like, hey, do you want to come on? He was like, hey, it's time for me to be on.
Yeah. What's he going to try to do? Calm markets down?
Maybe he's just going to show up and quit.
Is it going to be markets in turmoil? Wait, is he freaked out about asset prices crashing?
Right tail turmoil is the only turmoil we have right now.
No, I know. And that's why I'm saying I don't see any other reason for him to come on unless he's trying to justify why he's going to be more hawkish.
Well, the one I feel like the hard sell is to be.
Nobody ever says, can I come on 60 minutes because we're going to do more of what we've done over the last 16 years?
We'll see. I think he often goes on when it's time to
pivot,
let everyone know it's time to turn the super tanker around. But also, like, if there was ever a time to go take an inflation victory lap, now's the time to do that.
Here's the other thing I think is really interesting. I look at the size of our economy and I look at all that. Another reason why I think data is screwed up, I think if you had legitimate 4 to 4.5% growth, you'd have inflation higher than 2.5%.
Not if you get a productivity boom again. That is how you sterilize inflation.
Okay, let's talk about this, okay? Mm-hmm. Because if you have millions of people work from home, corporations no longer have to pay that. At the same time, government stuffing people in money's pockets, that's your productivity boom. It's making it look like what does a productivity boom do? A productivity boom frees up a bunch of capital, right, that was previously needed to – and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, on a textbook definition, right? It's that all of a sudden this process that used to require $10 to create X widget now requires $6. You've freed up that capital for it to do other things, right? That capital, that process has become much more productive. It's become much more less capital intensive. And now that capital is free. Well, so think about it. You got all these people, you like overnight, take this chunk out of everybody's overhead and then stuff consumers' pockets full of it's going to look like a productivity boom, isn't it?
I would agree with you if you had a bunch of inflation too. So
we did
is the key there, because we don't anymore. For the last 9 months we haven't, like,
well, but that's because you're not, those things stop doing, they stop going up.
The point I'm making, so we didn't have productivity ripping when inflation was ripping. It's been ripping since. So inflation's come all the way back down to essentially 2 on a 6-9 month basis. But then despite that fact, incomes are still really high. Income growth is still doing way like above trend. Consumption is accelerating and is above trend. Output in most measures is like above trend. The economy, typically, if you get inflation go from 9 to 2, growth gets whacked in that time. And it hasn't. Like, growth is like, cool, I don't care. Like, I'm staying up here despite the fact that inflation is going away. And to me, the explanation for that is the fact that it's productivity. Now, if we still had like 6-7% inflation, then it'd be like, okay, yeah, you're just throwing free money at us, and we're just using it to make things look good. Versus,
I know, but you're going back on what we talked about the other day, though, because we were sitting there saying that productivity is such a tough thing to pin down. Meaning, of all of
the source of it, I would say is tough to pin.
Well, in all economic data, the timing of it is always the tough part. Meaning, right, like the, you know, getting the economic picture right is one thing, but getting the timing right as far as when things are picked up by economic, that's really tough. What you're making an argument is saying that it has to be a real productivity boom because of the timing of it. I mean, like, it wouldn't surprise me at all if let's say, and I'm sure it's more complicated than this, but let's just say for the sake of argument, the productivity boom's coming from what I'm talking about, right? It wouldn't shock me if the data didn't start picking that up for 12 to 16 months after the fact.
Well, I mean, we're tracking how,
especially with all the damage that was done to the economy right out of the gates. Like, it makes sense to me that there was a lag and then the productivity boom showed up later.
I don't know. It's not how I see it. I see a lot of like, so like the thing that got us off the scent of everything that's happened, got us thinking recession. There's tons of data suggesting, hey, you're about to hit a recession. And then here we are with 4% growth. Even if it's 2.5 in real life or 2 or something, it's still above trend growth, despite the fact that like hours work, if you look just straight up hours worked, it's at levels 100% that suggests you're in a recession. But growth is really robust. Wage gains are really robust. Consumption's really robust. Production's really robust. That again, it suggests like, well, you don't need the hours to get the production. That
I know, but so if all of that is true, then this is unlike, well, I mean, we know it's unlike any other cycle in history, but if that is true, how can all of those positive things be true and all of these other things are getting left behind? How can those things run at the same time? Right, productivity booming, income surging. Listen to that narrative you just laid out. Meanwhile, Apple and Nike can't get anybody to buy their stuff. I mean, they're still selling a lot of it, but you know what I mean. Like you're looking at these stalwart consumer companies.
They're buying it all from Microsoft and Meta, I guess.
But what? There's not enough stuff for people to buy from Microsoft and Meta. It's all business to business stuff.
Because
probably 85% of both of their income statements are responsible from businesses or business activities, right?
Sure. Like
Facebook leads and all, you know, and Microsoft Teams and all that kind of
stuff. So maybe that's it though, is you can argue a lot of the tools those companies sell are productivity enhancing tools.
There is no question about that.
So them making a bunch of money tells me shoving productivity everyone's throat.
Yeah, but that's all tied to my work from home thing.
Well, to a point. I mean, we don't work from home much here, and I use the heck out of Microsoft and Google tools, and they definitely make me more productive.
Yeah, no,
and I'm not banging out widgets, but
yeah, no. So I'm just My whole point is saying like, I see that as like a I just see that I know that that's technically productivity. I see it differently than that because. If we chalk all that up to, I mean, a productivity boom should not, usually a productivity boom is not going to be the seed corn for a real estate collapse.
Are you suggesting we're having a real estate collapse?
I'm confused. No, like I'm just saying, like not real, that's too general, but like commercial office space, right? Like meaning a productivity boom.
Well, I think you've just made the argument that those two are tied at the hip. The fact that commercial real estate is having problems and productivity is booming.
No, but what I'm saying is like a lot of things right now, you've got to file that under productivity. But
here's how I'll counter what you
like
just said.
The automobile was cell phones were a boost in product, right? Like all this kind of stuff. People switching over to like the stuff we're talking about that I think is responsible for the quote unquote productivity boom we're seeing. Those things are not permanent. Like meaning it's not really a, like people are, companies are not, like, this is not a permanent shift. I think you're going to see over time that work from home thing normalize more. I don't think you're going to go all the way back to where it was before, just because I think too many businesses there's a lot of businesses that you looked at over the years and went, what do you guys buy that big office building for, right? Like, it's just a lot of wasted money and space. Mm-hmm. Then there are other businesses where, like, for instance, you know, people would think that about the finance business. I think it's the exact, like, I find a high value being able to be in the same room, especially like our staff wouldn't need it as much. Like, I think they could probably be fine. But like for the investment group that we've got here, I need to be in the same room. I mean, we can dial Marcos in on the, you know, but being able to, you know, for instance, you and I and Matt being able to sit in the same office and have a conversation, there's a value that comes from that. Anyway, my whole point is saying, like, I see that as like a temporary shift that makes companies temporarily more profitable. And I know you have to file it in productivity, and I'm probably splitting hairs here, but anyway, I just... So-
One thing I want to add, and then we should probably leave productivity behind, but because you're saying like, okay, like, well, how is that going to be the case? But then there's like these dead bodies.
Well, for instance, what you said, you were like, a lot of people screw off at home. It's not a productivity boom. It's a cost cutting. It's kind of like a reshuffling of the business to make the overhead go down. You're not getting, so moving people to home does not increase their output.
Right. But what we're seeing to me is increased output.
But if you do get the same amount of production from that employee without having to pay the overhead of the building.
There you go.
There is a productivity.
Right.
I guess you could.
But I think looking at the suite of tools that person working from home has now compared to 5-10 years ago.
A lot more.
They can do a lot.
Yeah. Even truthfully, even 5 years.
Right.
Meaning some of those programs exist, but nobody was really using them.
Right.
You know, like, I look at how much more we utilize DocuSign compared to where we did pre-COVID, right? You can
just that is a, and just being able to Zoom someone real quick, like, genuinely helps. But what I would say is, like, you're kind of like saying, like, well, then how are we have all this weakness over here? But I would argue that is what productivity looks like. Is if you have a productivity boom, you will have a lot of dead bodies float up because you're going to inherently get rid of some things that aren't productive enough.
Like buggy whip makers.
Right. When you mentioned like the automobile, my first thought was like, well, yeah, like that smoked, you know, the buggy whip, like the people that were raising the horses and everything for the buggies, like it was a bad time for them, but that's because of the productivity.
Yeah. But how many net jobs did Amazon cut last year? You know what Ford wasn't doing in the 20s? They weren't laying people off.
But again, like on net, we're not laying people off.
Well, again, assuming that all the data points are right. But I mean, but what I'm saying though is
they're not. But
I know. But okay. But if the companies that are driving the productivity boom are the ones laying people off,
that suggests the productivity boom. Look at. I mean, we know Meta is going to let some people go, right? And look at their quarter. I mean, they're making it rain with less people. That is by definition productivity.
Well,
just going through the roof.
I think they're a bad example, just because. They were going to have an impressive quarter no matter what, especially over a year-over-year basis. That's
true, but even looking at what they're saying about the, you know, the next year, and this goes for a lot of the names. There were times I was getting concerned about some of these companies because they were letting people go. And I'm like, well, if you're a growth company and you're letting a bunch of people go, like, how does this work? But then they let people go, and then they proved like, no, we're still growing fine. It's just. We can do it with less people.
Yeah. No. I mean, well, and that was one of the reasons why Meta's always been one of the ones that we've held in that basket was because, and if you think about it, like we look at where they gin up the majority of their revenue and profit from. And I think that it's, if you understand who their customers are, I think you can make the case that as far as their main revenue line goes, it may appear at times to be somewhat recessionary proof, meaning Facebook ads. We've used them before. Now we don't now just because we've got our own marketing, you know, set up and we've got our platform built. It's more efficient, but Facebook ads for the money, they are shockingly good. Like I talk to people all the time, leads, you know, where do you get lead source? And I'm like going, hey, if you're looking for the most bang for your buck, man, Facebook ads. And my point in saying that is you could see in a recessionary time, more people turning to a service like that. Right. So Facebook is, I think Google is kind of similar. And it's funny to me that those have been, I mean, Facebook came roaring back. I think Google will probably do that at some point in the next year too, just because they're both like that. But Yeah, I don't know. I like I texted you to earlier this morning, you and I were talking about this, and I just said I'm at a complete loss. Other than the fact that I know that you can't be short them. And they're putting up pretty – like I said, it's almost like we have two separate stock markets. We've got the Meg 7 stock market, and we've got everything else. And
100%. That's for at least a year now, a little over.
Yeah, I mean, you could say it's been longer than that. I mean, with the NASDAQ almost doubled up the S&P in its run this over this last 15 years, which makes sense when you look at the companies at the top.
The crazy thing is, going back 2.5 years, NASDAQ's up like 5-6%.
Well, here's the other thing too, and I am not doing this, and I'm not suggesting anybody else does it too. I think you make an argument: the bigger those companies get, the less likely they are to face legislation, antitrust legislation.
You can make that argument either way. Yeah,
they're carrying a lot of weight right now economically. They're carrying a lot of weight.
They are, and if you look at like trade war and geopolitical stuff with, you know, like against China, how do you outcompete your enemies if you kneecap your innovators? You know,
if somebody this is a thing that I honestly think in the not too distant future is going to be an issue that we are dealing with as a country. Because if these companies, I think the internet has enabled something that's never existed before. Do you realize that if those companies were to double from here, now they would be, they couldn't do that unless the American, but they are gaining on those companies could feasibly make, could be the same, they could make up, their valuation could be in the next 5 to 7 years, realistically, they could be 60 to 70% the entire size of our economy. And I think that in and of itself is a danger.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's very, very dangerous.
Well, because if they are, right, look at the power.
Meta went up $200 billion today.
Today. And think about the ability that gives them to influence politicians, like influence. And we know they're already doing it. Like this is, it's fascinating. Because I don't know the answers. I don't know where it's all going. But you're just sitting, it feels like we're living in a sci-fi movie.
Yeah, 100%.
You know what I mean? So anyway, well, what else? I know you got to run. What else? Closing up. What are we looking for? And we were going to talk about what we're going to do. I mean, at this point, I think we got to figure it out whether we're going to go with the. And just for the listeners, we're debating. We'll see the way it rolls out. But I think the board, and I think you agree, you cannot be short this stuff. And in this environment, I really think. Obviously, we want to see what, you know, follow through for next week, but it feels like it's increasingly looking like you need to be long these things with a net underneath you.
Yeah, or as my good friend Jason has been pleading and saying, you know, hey, it's the golden age of options. Like we've talked about it a little bit, and that is introducing essentially right tail hedging through options. That is still to me a very good. Approach, and one that you can just set aside a very fixed amount of money and put it out there, and a smaller, you know, piece of money. So you don't have to tie up, you know, 20, 30, 40% of your portfolio and stuff you don't really want to own just to protect the right tail. And you can, you know, always have that 1-2%, whatever it is, maybe up to 5, just always hedging that right tail. Every pullback, buy some calls. And
yeah. And it also is I think it's another way to, you know, rather than fighting the current, swimming with it, meaning, you know, rather than pounding your head against the table like I have for years now about volatility being dead, you know, the make volatility great again. We pulled those out too early, didn't we?
thanks, Cuppy.
way to curse us on that one, Cupster. but you know, that to go to your point, it's also a good way to quit fighting that and take advantage of low volatility.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's a way to make a lot of things work for you, and to do it, even though I think we all view, or maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but I view options as very complex and complicated and has math in it. And it has, you know, at least 2 more variables than a regular investment. So I think a lot of people just want to avoid it because of that. But at the end of the day, you can better define your risk in an option than you can anything else. You can know exactly how much you're risking. And then you have the just built-in convexity of it's either going back to nothing, and I just, well, there went 1%, like that was worth the hedge, or it can go, you know, supernova for you. So if we do have the NASDAQ double in an 18-month period or something, You know, if you had a reasonably aggressive call built in, like,
you know what an interesting little portfolio would be right now, like having like a 15 to 20% slice of the portfolio strictly options based, and then take the rest of the portfolio and make it like a mix of really short term and like 2 year treasuries. You know what I mean? Because
right, one is an outright inflation hedge, and one's an outright recession hedge. Things get bad, and then one's a right tail hedge. That way, like you can play the portfolio down the middle with value and things you like and things you think make sense, and then you have kind of the bad side hedged and the good side hedged.
Yeah, and it's a way to be levered without really being levered. If you think about it, it's almost like a risk parity thing. Just like if you did that, right? Like
it's a smarter one. Yeah.
A smarter one. It's an unlevered risk parity portfolio. But if you were like 80% short term fixed income and 20% long options, it'd be interesting to play with it, because if you did the option side correctly, even if you only had 15 to 20% of the portfolio.
And I don't think you have to go that high because of the built in just natural convexity you can get.
And it gives you plenty of room to keep up with the market with that amount of money, or like you said, probably even smaller amounts.
Yeah.
That'd be a really nice retirement portfolio in this environment.
100%.
Yeah. Because you know, if any of those black swan events do happen, those bonds are going to rip.
Yeah. It's just like any tail risk hedging you see, like where you'll see these funds that just specialize in it, and they sit there and just kind of bleed a little bit. And the next thing you know, it's like, oh, well, we had 1,000% month. And yeah. It's like, well,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That pays the bills.
Yeah.
All right, pal. Well, hopefully you guys glean something from this. I think this is the time to have a bigger imagination and to widen your universe of possible outcomes. And as always, manage risk. So until next week, we'll see you then. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.